Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Tens of thousands of Ethiopian migrants have been stranded in war-ravaged Yemen, where they continue to be subjected to arbitrary detention and exposure to COVID-19 infection, forcible relocation and abuse, the UN said on Tuesday. The alert from the International Organization for Migration, IOM, follows reports that an airstrike on Sunday in northwest Hadja Governorate killed 7 children and 2 women. The UN's humanitarian coordinator in Yemen, Lise Grande, said in a statement that it was incomprehensible in the middle of the COVID pandemic that civilians continue being killed. The country has long been a stepping stone for migrants seeking work in the oil-rich Arabian states to the north of Yemen, but landing points across from the Horn of Africa have become increasingly dangerous since conflict escalated in March 2015 between the forces of President Abrabu Mansour Hadi, supported by a Saudi-led international coalition, and mainly Houthi militia for control of the Arab nation. Here's IOM spokesperson Paul Dillon.
For nearly 6 years, Yemen has been an extremely unsafe place to be a migrant. COVID-19 has made this situation worse. Migrants are scapegoated as carriers of the virus, and as a result, suffer exclusion and violence. In addition to the forced removals, fears about COVID-19 have led to migrants in Yemen experience verbal and physical harassment, increased detention, and movement restrictions.
Today, widely described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, fears that COVID-19 has already gained a strong foothold in Yemen have been compounded by a potential famine alert last week from the World Food Programme, WFP, as some 10 million people face acute food shortages. Nearly 1,000 civilian conflict-related casualties have also been reported in Yemen in the first 6 months of 2020. To the Human Rights Council, which has been hearing how the challenges facing Burundi have not gone away just because of the death of President Pierre Nkurunziza. Addressing member states in Geneva, UN-appointed independent investigator Dudu Dien said that intimidation, threats and serious human rights violations were still a feature of politics in the country. Members of Burundi's main opposition party, the National Freedom Council, CNL, had even been executed, according to Mr. Dien, head of the UN Commission of Inquiry on Burundi. Although the presidential, legislative and local elections in May had seen relatively strong participation by women, the investigator warned that Senate and other upcoming elections had been marred by violent incidents and multiple human rights violations. Despite Mr. Nkurunziza's death on the 8th of June, the ruling party remains unchanged, the UN-appointed rights expert continued. In an appeal to the new president and former general Evariste Ndayishimiye, the UN Commission of Inquiry urged him to demonstrate his will for change by cooperating with international human rights mechanisms or by reopening the UN Office for Human Rights in Burundi. The immediate release of the 4 Iwacu journalists and human rights defenders such as Germaine Rukuki and Nesta Nibitanga would also be significant gestures, Mr. Dien said. Burundi rejected the UN panel's findings, which it claimed benefited the Burundian political opposition. Bahrain should reconsider carrying out the death penalty on 2 men who were tortured before confessing to involvement in a bomb attack, the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, said on Tuesday. In a statement, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights noted that Mohamed Ramadan and Hussein Musa Ali Musa Mohamed were reportedly arrested without a warrant after the February 2014 incident in which a police officer was killed. They were convicted in December 2014 and sentenced to death. That decision was upheld by Bahrain's highest court on Monday. UN Human Rights Office spokesperson Liz Throssell told journalists that it was deeply concerned by the development. She urged the Bahraini authorities to halt immediately any plans to execute the men, quash their convictions, and conduct a retrial in accordance with international human rights norms and standards. While noting that those responsible for the attack should be held to account, Ms. Throssell also urged Bahrain to ensure that its domestic laws were brought into line with international human rights law. The Gulf state should also investigate all allegations of arbitrary arrest and detention, torture and the use of forced confessions, the UN human rights official added. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As we come on the air, the Midwest of America is struggling with widespread floods. Hundreds of thousands of farm animals died and a few people. The damage to roads, homes, and bridges is extensive, but the damage to the food system and even long-standing family farms may take years to recover, if ever. Fields have been washed away or covered in sand and sludge. All that as the spring melt and floods are just beginning. That huge story has dropped out of most media coverage. My thanks to all the listeners who sent tips and videos of that event. The extremes that scientists have been predicting for years as we overheat the planet. Even more deeply hidden from our comfortable lives, Cyclone Idai has ravaged East Africa. In early March, extra heavy rains flooded Malawi before becoming a cyclone, or hurricane as we know it in the north. Cyclone Idai struck Zimbabwe and Mozambique in the middle of March. Malawi has about 87,000 displaced people in camps. In Mozambique, the city of Beira, with 500,000 people, was almost demolished. Parts of Zimbabwe are still cut off. Hundreds lost their lives. Likely millions of people are without food tonight and without hope of planting a new crop. Aid is starting to trickle in, but really, many people will never recover, just as Puerto Rico has not yet recovered from Hurricane Maria 2 years ago. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released their report on extreme weather events back in 2012, with more in 2013 and following. Half a dozen years ago, we knew this would happen. In this show, we learned something new. There is an upper limit to the amount of CO2 we can emit before essential subtropical clouds stop shading the Earth. That is cloud doomsday, with Earth's temperature soaring 8 degrees C or 14 degrees Fahrenheit. We have reasons to hope that will never come, but if we do go there, that is the end. You will hear that new science from the lead author at NASA. Then we switch over to things we can do. From the Post Carbon Institute, Jason Bradford predicts the long tide of humans into cities will reverse. The future is food, and it's local. But there are things we can do right now to prepare for the end of fossil fuels and continuing climate threats. This is Radio EcoShock. Let's go. What if great masses of clouds disappear as the world warms? Without their shade, planet Earth could get 8 degrees C hotter or 14 degrees Fahrenheit of additional heat. That, I think, would be game over for life as we know it. It sounds like science fiction, but new science says it could be possible. This comes from an award-winning scientist. Dr. Tapio Schneider is a professor of environmental science and engineering at California Institute of Technology and senior research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. His paper, Possible Climate Transitions from Breakup of Stratocumulus Decks Under Greenhouse Warming, was published in the journal Nature on February 25, 2019. Tapio Schneider, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Is it fair to say you discovered an atmospheric breaking point where greenhouse gases can prohibit the formation of the most dominant type of cloud on Earth?
Yes, at least we showed that this is possible. And this is about stratocumulus clouds, primarily in the subtropics. So it doesn't mean that clouds everywhere would disappear, but one very common cloud type in the subtropics may be replaced by cumulus clouds, more scattered, typical tropical postcard clouds.
And are those stratocumulus clouds prevalent enough that it would make a real difference to Earth's heat budget if they were not there in the subtropics?
Yes, these clouds make a huge difference to Earth's energy balance. So they reflect sunlight, they shade the Earth, and thereby exert a cooling effect in the subtropics that then is communicated to the rest of the globe through energy transport. It has long been recognized that they're enormously important for Earth, regulating Earth temperature, Earth energy balance.
And for the rest of us, if we're staring out at the sky, what would we see when we're looking at stratocumulus clouds?
It's just a white blanket on the sky. And people, for example, where I live in California, are very familiar with it. It's a marine layer that sometimes comes over land in May and June in particular. But you see the same clouds in mid-latitudes. They're very common.
And you describe in your paper the mechanics behind the formation of stratocumulus clouds, but it seems a little complicated for the average person. How would you explain that thermal radiation mechanism to a 10-year-old?
Well, let me try. I have a 9-year-old at home. I haven't tried to explain that to him yet. But so the key is that these clouds are rather special in how the turbulence that sustains them is driven. Many clouds are driven by warming from below. So the sun heats the surface and air masses rise. moist air masses rise. As they rise, they cool. And at some point, the water and it condenses and forms a cloud. That's, for example, how cumulus clouds in the tropics work. Stratocumulus clouds are a little different. For any cloud to form, you need to have air masses rising, and as they rise, they cool, and then at some point, water condenses. But the air masses rising under the stratocumulus clouds, that rising is actually driven by cooling in the clouds themselves. So the clouds themselves cool, and then the cooler air masses sink to the bottom and come back up as moist air masses that then nourish the clouds. And the cooling in the clouds happens because effectively the clouds radiate heat upwards at the cloud tops, and that cools them. It's like a radiator fin in a car, for example. And that cooling becomes less efficient as more greenhouse gases accumulate in the atmosphere above them. They basically can't cool themselves as well anymore. It's much like, you know, Earth's surface cools itself by radiating heat upwards, and so that's how, for example, nights in the desert become relatively cool. And if there's a cloud over a desert and the night is warmer because the surface can't radiate heat upward as effectively anymore and can't cool itself as effectively anymore. So it's essentially the same for the clouds. So the cloud tops can't cool as effectively anymore when there are more greenhouse gases above them.
All right, so let's picture a warmer atmosphere later on in this century or in the next. And there's more carbon dioxide up there in parts per million. There's more methane in parts per billion. There's nitrous oxide. How do these greenhouse gases interfere with the formation of stratocumulus clouds?
So these gases make it harder for the clouds to cool themselves at their tops. And the cooling is what propels air masses down towards the surface, where they pick up moisture, come back up as moist air masses that sustain the clouds. And if the cooling gets so inefficient that these air masses are no longer propelled all the way to the surface, and then they can't pick up moisture at the ocean surface, then the clouds just break up. They break up into these cumulus clouds that are more scattered and more driven by heating from below rather than cooling from above.
Discovering a kind of doom limit for greenhouse gas levels seems pretty darn important. Tapio Schneider, why did we not know this limit was there before?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, all the ingredients, the mechanisms we are talking about, they're all well known. We didn't discover them. The key mechanisms have been known for at least 20 years. But I think the piece that we contributed is explaining how what happens when the cloud scale mechanisms can interact with a surface that changes. So the key new thing is that as cloud cover diminishes, there's more sunlight hitting the surface, more sunlight being absorbed at the surface, then the surface heats. And as the surface heats, that in turn leads to more water vapor in the atmosphere, and water vapor itself is a greenhouse gas, which works against the existence of the cloud. So there's a feedback loop there of cloud cover being diminished, surface warming leading to further reduced cloud cover. And that feedback loop, while with hindsight it seems obvious it's there, but that had not been explained before. That was the new piece. But I think it could have been discovered earlier.
Do current climate models produce cloud levels that match what satellites actually observe?
Unfortunately not, especially for the stratocumulus clouds. It's a well-known problem for climate modeling. They're very challenging to model because the scales of the turbulence that sustains them is quite small. It's just meters to tens of meters that matter here. Climate models can only resolve motions of tens of kilometers or so. So climate models cannot resolve these clouds. They're represented in semi-empirical fashions by linking cloud cover to temperature, humidity, and the like in the atmosphere. But this is notoriously inaccurate. So climate models generally strongly underestimate the prevalence of stratocumulus clouds, often by a factor of two or three in the subtropics.
Does this flaw in climate models suggest that predictions made by agencies like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change may be off?
Well, they're uncertain, and the IPCC is very open about it. It's clearly disclosed in the IPCC reports that confidence in anything involving cloud cover changes is low. They stated expressly, and it's a well-known limitation of climate models and climate predictions. They may be off in a sense that maybe even the mean is different, or the most likely value is different from what the IPCC report stated. There's a new IPCC report coming up in a few years. We'll see. how these estimates will be revised.
But there's a problem still with future modelers using what you have learned, because you say we've reached some sort of limit of computing power.
Well, I think climate models can be improved given the computing power we have, and that's something we're working on actively as a multi-institutional group called the Climate Modeling Alliance that has set itself the goal to make climate models, and including these cloud processes, much better. I think it can be done. It requires innovation, it requires effort, but I think it's very possible. I hope within 5 years we'll have more accurate, more precise predictions of climate changes, cloud cover changes, and in particular that we have better ways of quantifying the uncertainties in those changes, which right now is difficult. All that being said, I mean, you mentioned the tipping point in the clouds. I think it's important to keep in mind that it would be very, very far away to occur on Earth. I mean, the minimum CO2 concentration that we saw where this was happening was 1,200 ppm, and it might be a good bit larger. We won't see this for at least a century, and I don't think we'll ever see CO2 concentrations this high.
Well, right. We don't want to overreact to this discovery. I mean, before we reach 1,200 parts per million carbon in the atmosphere, maybe industrial civilization will collapse. Maybe we'll run out of fossil fuels, or heaven knows, maybe we'll come to our senses and change our energy and lifestyles. I guess you have to offer that caution a lot.
Right. Or I think, to me, the most plausible scenario simply is that clever people will figure out how to produce electricity from sunlight cheaply, and that will replace burning of fossil fuels largely. And we'll just find better ways of having a good lifestyle without emitting carbon.
Let's talk about the things everybody wants to know a little bit more, and that is about the limit of the amount of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases we can add to the atmosphere before we hit this cloud-making barrier and maybe, if that should ever happen, suffer extreme warming. How certain are you about the limit, and how much latitude is there either side of around 1,200 parts per million?
So that number is very uncertain. I think we can be relatively clear what happens when you lose these stratocumulus clouds. You get these about 8 degrees centigrade warming. That's basic energy balance. That part is reasonably clear. There's some uncertainty about the number, but I don't think that's enormous. But the CO2 limit where that happens is very uncertain. So 1,200 ppm is the threshold we got when the atmospheric circulation didn't change in our simulations. But the atmospheric circulation, of course, will change as the climate warms. And some of the ways in which it changes, we understand. And when we include some of the changes that we understand in the simulations, then the limit where these clouds broke up moved to higher CO2 levels. So depending what you assume there was up to around 2,000 ppm. And so that number we cannot pinpoint with precision. And it may also not be a cliff that, say, there's 1,500 or whatever the right number is in the end, where everything suddenly changes. I think there will be, if this limit would be reached, there would be changes over some time, that in some regions these clouds disappear, maybe destabilize neighboring regions, and maybe first it happens seasonally, not year-round, and the like. So there would be spatial and temporal variations in the climate system that probably would smooth this out a bit. All of these things we cannot make firm statements about on the basis of the calculations we did. What I hope to be able to do is, what we did is simulate a relatively small patch of stratocumulus clouds, and what we're currently working on is embed many, many such patches in a climate model that we can capture some of these effects of heterogeneity and get better estimates of how the instability interacts with the atmospheric circulation.
How can your new theory help us understand what may have happened in previous episodes of abrupt warming in our planet's history?
Right. I think that's one of the most interesting questions to me. We know firmly now that there have been rapid and large climate changes in the geological past. 50 million years ago, Earth was much, much warmer than it is now, maybe something like 12 degrees centigrade warmer. Don't know precisely how much warmer, but we do know that there were crocodiles living in polar latitudes, or palm trees in very high latitudes. We just have fossil evidence of that. And it seems also pretty clear that the CO2 concentration at the time was high, but not enormously high. So it seems pretty clear it was below 2,000 parts per million. And if you take current climate models, for example, Matt Huber at Purdue University has done that and increases CO2 concentrations in those models by a lot, you don't get a climate that's warm enough, as in it's consistent with the geological record at CO2 concentrations below, say, 2,000 parts per million. What Matt had to do is increase the CO2 concentrations to more than 4,000 parts per million to get a climate that's consistent with the geological records we have of what climate was like at the time. And CO2 levels that high, people who work on this say they can be ruled out. So there's a bit of a mystery here. Is how could climate have been so warm as it seems it was without CO2 concentrations having been enormously high? And I think strong cloud feedbacks are a likely culprit just because we don't understand clouds very well and climate models don't do well in simulating them. And the mechanism we describe is one possibility of how you can get to very warm climates without excessive CO2 concentrations. In general, I would say the record of climates of the past is one of large swings over geological timescales that we do not understand well, and I think it asks us to be cautious with perturbing a system whose understanding is incomplete.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is climate expert Tapio Schneider from Caltech and NASA. We're talking about a dangerous limit in atmospheric carbon dioxide that could prevent the formation of key clouds that currently cool the Earth. In discussing your paper, you give the analogy of scientists with simple models discovering the runaway greenhouse effect, which may have occurred on the planet Venus. I remember James Hansen discussing that. That's a pretty unsettling example. How does it apply to your work, and are you suggesting this cloud shift could trigger a runaway greenhouse scenario?
No, the runaway greenhouse, the best evidence we have right now is that it cannot occur on Earth. Earth is just far enough away from the sun that probably can be ruled out. What I think in the discussion, the point I wanted to make is that the models for a runaway greenhouse effect we have are relatively simple. They're often one-dimensional models of the atmosphere, and yet they illustrate the key mechanisms, which are not in dispute. I think it's no longer seriously disputed that a runaway greenhouse can occur, and the evidence is strong that it did in fact occur on Venus. And I was just drawing an analogy to our work. There's a bit of a runaway effect of the clouds, the stratocumulus clouds disappearing, and we describe the mechanisms on the basis of a simplified model that, however, illustrates the key mechanisms, the key physics involved. So what you cannot do with simplified models is be quantitatively precise, for example, about the CO2 level when these clouds break up. We can't be very precise about it. But nonetheless, what we can do is say, here are the physical mechanisms. It's quite possible that this instability occurs. And I think that's analogous to the runaway greenhouse effect. Simple models exposed to mechanisms that made it clear that it's possible that this runaway greenhouse effect can occur. And for Venus, there's evidence, say, from the isotopic composition of the atmosphere, for example, that says it probably did occur there.
But this cloud greenhouse problem is an example of a nonlinear feedback process?
Right. It is a nonlinear feedback process in much the way that the runaway greenhouse effect is a nonlinear feedback process, but what runs away in our case is just a subtropical cloud cover. It's not the entire, it's not oceans starting to boil off as in a runaway greenhouse effect presumably occurred on Venus.
And you did try to chart the way back, like at what point could you go below that limit and expect the clouds to reform again? I was wondering why you would bother to do that, because if we did go up 8 degrees C or more, there may not be any of us here to worry about it, but you did try to do that calculation, and what did you find?
Well, when you reduce CO2 concentrations, the clouds do not immediately reform at the threshold at which they broke up. So you need to, in some calculations say where they broke up at 1,200 ppm or 1,300 ppm, you needed to go back to 300 or 200 ppm CO2 before the clouds reformed. The motivation for doing that was not to make statements about the future, and in general, that wasn't the motivation for the paper. We were not trying to say that this will happen. We were just trying to say, here's a feedback that can possibly happen and may have happened, may have occurred in Earth past. And this going back to lower CO2 is relevant if you want to understand Earth past, right? We had episodes of high CO2 concentrations, so example, the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, only the early Eocene, but then greenhouse gas concentrations steadily dropped for millions of years. And if you are in one of these hothouse climate worlds, where, say, presumably you didn't have these stratocumulus clouds, or very few of them, but then for geological reasons, increased weathering and the like, CO2 levels drop. Results show at some point these clouds can reform, and maybe at some point even quite suddenly, leading to quite suddenly in geological times, leading to, in that case, a considerably cooler climate. And again, the geological record is full of transitions between warmer and cooler climates that seem to happen relatively rapidly in geological timescales, and that's where I think our results may help offer an explanation.
I'm trying to straighten out in my own mind, if Earth loses the massive cooling provided by stratocumulus clouds, is the resulting 8 degrees C or 14 degrees Fahrenheit that you suggested, is that added to the temperatures that might already be in a much hotter world? For example, if we reach 6 degrees C at 1,200 parts per million, does Earth then go to a steaming 14 degrees C without those clouds?
Yes, that's the implication. The 8 degrees that we estimated is really just from the instability of the clouds. That's on top of whatever greenhouse warming you had before you get to them.
And your paper suggests without the clouds, the subtropics get even hotter than that, going 10 degrees C warmer. That's terrible news for South Australia, North Africa, South China, Middle East, the U.S. South, Mexico, parts of South America. Why do the subtropics get even hotter rather than an evenly distributed heat over the globe?
So the clouds on which we focus are subtropical stratocumulus clouds. So if you lose them in the subtropics, and of course the subtropics warm first and warm most, the extra heat accumulating in the subtropics is then transported to other parts of the globe and warm the rest of the globe. And that's why it's more in the subtropics than elsewhere.
I've seen estimates from Caltech and other places that our current rate of emissions growth, if we go business as usual, we could reach 1,200 parts per million CO2 sometime in the next century. To me, that doesn't seem that far away. It's a few generations until possible cloud doom. What makes you so optimistic that we're not going to get there?
Various reasons, but I think the important thing to keep in mind is that even before you would see any such breakup of stratocumulus clouds, climate change would have severe adverse effects from the warming that you mentioned, leading to extreme precipitation and the like. I think people are clearly starting to see that some of that is already happening, and I think it's spurring people into action, and it's fostering innovation. For example, the ways in which we produce energy, and I think what makes me reasonably optimistic is that I think we have a history of underestimating technological progress, and progress in, for example, solar power is quite enormous. The last 20 years, the cost of solar power has decreased so much that it's not far away anymore. To the cost of producing electricity from solar power is not that far from the cost of electricity production from coal burning, for example. And once these two cost curves cross, you get exponential transformation of entire industries and reductions in carbon emissions. In many countries, it's already cheaper to install a new solar power plant than building a new coal power plant. And, I think we'll see more of that. And 1,200 ppm and higher is so far out that I think that technological transition will happen before we get there.
Previous to your new research, other scientists suggested creating more clouds, either by spraying seawater from ships or spraying sulfates from airplanes. What do you think of that geoengineering, and could it replace the shade currently provided by stratocumulus clouds if we needed to?
The evidence is mixed how well that works. I mean, the geoengineering part that I think is possible is to put aerosols, for example, sulfates into the stratosphere. That's feasible. There's maybe a possible stopgap measure to prevent some warming for some time. Seeding clouds in the subtropics, it is not clear how effective that will be. I think it raises interesting questions scientifically. I mean, the issue here is that microphysics of droplet formation and the like in the clouds is not as well understood as we would like it to be. And it's important that we understand that better so that we can model these clouds better. So one way of viewing experiments you do to test what the effect of seeding is on these clouds is just in purely scientific terms of what is the effect of aerosols, cloud condensation nuclei on the optical properties of the clouds, which is something we need to know to make better climate models. And I hope we'll see more research that addresses those questions.
Tapio, I think we need a name for this newly found limit to clouds. I might suggest the cloud barrier, but what do you call it?
Didn't even think about a name. You have no name.
Yeah. Well, then you're going to leave it up to bloggers.
Yeah, I mean, when we talked about the work while we were doing it, we always talked about the threshold where the breakup occurs or the transition, stratocumulus to cumulus. In a way, the transition from stratocumulus to cumulus occurs naturally right now, right? If you go westward, say, from California, you fly first over stratocumulus decks that then give way to cumulus, and there's a very similar transition occurring naturally in space, I think, could then occur in time as greenhouse gases increase. And that's just called the stratocumulus-cumulus transition. So I think we used the term transition. We talked about it because of that.
I think a name could be important, and I think it's important that policymakers, for example, know that there is a barrier out there, because I've heard some pretty wild things from, mainly from industry usually, but, oh, no problem, we'll go to 1,000 parts per million, it's been like that in the past, or we'll go to 1,500, it's been like that in the past, and your study says, no, there's a real big danger out there. It's far out there, but it is there, and I think it's important for people to know that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it will be hard to get policymakers to think of timescales of hundreds or hundreds of years. I think we'll probably need to focus on the more shorter-term impacts that are more certain.
Okay. And what are the big questions, as we wrap up here, what are the big questions in atmospheric science that you would like to work on?
In general, how clouds respond to climate change, not just stratocumulus, but other types of clouds as well, is probably the most important question we need to answer to get better climate predictions, and I and several others are working on it intensely. There are other questions. We talked about climate changes in the more distant past, ice age cycles, the cyclic variations between ice ages and warmer periods. We do not fully understand. There are greenhouse gas concentrations change along with temperature, but there's clearly a feedback not only from greenhouse gas concentrations on temperature, but also the other way around. The temperature affects greenhouse gas concentration in some fashion through biological processes, most likely. Those processes we also need to understand better. It relates to the question where a lot of the carbon that we are emitting is going right now. Only about half the carbon dioxide that's being emitted is accumulating in the atmosphere. The other half is taken up by oceans and by the land. It's not quite clear where and how. It's clearly important to understand that if you want to predict our climate future, say if this carbon sink soaks up about half the carbon that's being emitted, if that changes, if it becomes less effective, more carbon would end up in the atmosphere, we would get more severe climate change, and we don't understand that very well either. I think that's another important question. In general, I would say, I mean, the climate sciences are a great area to work in because there are so many really fundamental questions that are still open and that are calling for an answer, and it's a really good area for young scientists to get involved in because you're in the process of discovering how the system works, and it's important and interesting to be part of that discovery.
We have been speaking with Dr. Tapio Schneider, professor at California Institute of Technology and senior research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. You can find links to his new paper, Possible Climate Transitions from Breakup of Stratocumulus Decks Under Greenhouse Warming, in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Tapio, thank you so much for sharing your valuable work with us.
Exactly. Okay, thank you so much. It was nice talking with you. We were very well prepared.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The wave of humans into cities continues around the world. But what if we can't find the fossil fuels to support those billions of people? Or we can't use them due to climate change? Can city building reverse into a pulse of humanity back to country life? Jason Bradford thinks so. Jason is a biologist, a farmer, and board president of the Post-Carbon Institute. He is here to talk about his latest report, The Future is Rural: Food System Adaptations to the Great Simplification. From Corvallis, Oregon, Jason Bradford, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, thanks for having me, Alex.
All right, so how does a biologist become a farmer, Jason?
Oh, that's a little bit of a long story. It wasn't really planned. Life sort of happened. I guess, you know, general biology is a very good background for agriculture. It's just an applied biological science. And I was really an academic researcher interested in issues related to global change and biodiversity loss. And I became kind of frustrated, just didn't feel like writing another paper that 8 people might read was doing much. So my wife and I moved to, with our kids, moved to a small town, and she's a physician. So I really didn't have to worry about, you know, keeping a roof over my head, and kind of, you know, re-educated myself in farming. And then I ended up moving from the small town in Northern California up here to Corvallis, Oregon, and started an investment company that worked on agriculture and working on regenerative systems in farming.
Right, and there's a lot of that shows up in your report, and I love some of the details that you have from actually doing it. I lived in the country. I moved to the city. Now I'm back in a rural village. I love it here. Is that a common story, and do you think it will become the common story?
You know, I don't know if it's so common in the U.S. right now, but, you know, you see this maybe happening or going to happen more in areas that have more recently urbanized, where people have ties back to a home village or town. You know, they might migrate to the city, struggle there, and then maybe have a place to go back. I think it's a little harder in places like the U.S., where we've really depopulated the rural areas and very few people are actually tied to working on the land anymore. You know, where does somebody go back to? So, you know, I think you maybe are unusual in the United States, but it's probably a global pattern that you see once in a while when economies falter, and we'll probably start seeing that more around the world.
Yes, I've met people in India, and I've talked to people from China who still have very close ties to their village, and in fact, they sort of look at themselves as being an external part of the village where they can go back for family gatherings and meals, and there's a lot of back and forth in other countries, I think.
Yeah.
What is the great simplification?
Well, this is a term that my friend Nate Hagans uses to describe the possible trajectory of human civilization sort of this century, you know, later this century and following that. I believe we're likely peaking now in terms of what is called social complexity. And you could think of this as, you know, how diverse and long are these networks of trade that we have, job specialization, all of which parallels what we call globalization. And as this unwinds due to less energy of becoming available to societies, they'll sort of decomplexify, or better said, they'll simplify. And this is likely to be messy.
I'm wondering, though, is that predicted movement toward the countryside based more on the peak oil theory, which you've just expressed, or on limitations that we're going to have to place on carbon emissions because of, if we don't, we're going to hit unsurvivable climate change?
That's a really good question. I mean, I don't think and haven't really seen evidence that societies are going to intentionally wean themselves off of fossil fuels as much as we make these proclamations. So, you know, ministers go to a meeting and say, yes, we will wean ourselves off fossil fuels, but then in the next meeting, they're setting up policies that are going to encourage exploration and of fossil fuels. So it doesn't look like people were following through on any of these pledges. And it doesn't look like we're wisely allocating our remaining stocks of fossil fuels to make a smooth transition. So what my thinking in writing this report is that we're kind of rushing headlong towards a wall or a cliff or whatever metaphor you want to use of resource limits. And oil is one of them. It's a key one. And then we'll be left hanging. So what does someone do who understands this? And, you know, when writing Congress and sending checks to your local environmental groups hasn't led to any kind of change of course.
When I read between the lines of your new report, Jason, I don't see a pleasant adventure like the back-to-the-land dream of the 1970s. This great simplification, it could be a wrenching experience, maybe driven by panic or outright hunger. What do you think?
Yeah, it could be pretty bad, and that's why you have a lot of worry around the world right now with kids going on strikes, for, you know, school strikes, and, you know, they're outright calling it the Extinction Rebellion. So I wrote this report because I wanted to lower the odds of the worst outcomes. You know, if we do nothing and just pretend business as usual can go on, then the worst outcome is more likely. And perhaps if enough work is done now to prepare the food system, energy systems for a transformation, then it can reorganize somewhat more gracefully. And this is why I frame this in terms of resilience science. It helps people, I think, see the role of the time. You can't necessarily expect the system as it is to know what to do. It's kind of locked into its current, you know, way of doing things. And so there has to be some kind of stress that makes everyone sort of see, wait a second, this isn't working, and pulls, you know, lets you pull the system into a new state. You know, the other thing I want to emphasize is that I'm not so much saying that everyone needs to move back to countryside or that this will happen really quickly. I'm looking at kind of long-term demographic shifts as global trade networks falter and nations and regions need to become more self-reliant. And so, you know, like we were saying about rural people or people that can move back to their rural village, if you're a jobless but motivated person, then a frugal life on a farm or in your village may be a way to get by and feel like you're doing something important. And a lot of people are going to be attracted to that life with some sort of meaning and some sort of sense of control.
Well, this is something that has really attracted me over the years to the Post-Carbon Institute, because we have a situation where the international agencies, when they do their planning, or the World Bank, any of those, they just sort of take the present and they double it, or they expand everything to look like it is right now, but a lot more of it. And that's not going to work. We're not going to have the fossil fuels, and we're not going to be able to have a climate that we can live through. So how does the Post-Carbon Institute try and seed the thoughts and the processes that we're going to need to make that transition?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a nutty situation we're in where it just doesn't add up. And it doesn't take a whole lot to look through this and see the problem that we're planning for a future that either can't happen because there's just not enough materials on the planet to allow us to do this, or if we really keep pushing it, the planetary ecosystem will break down, and those are called consequences, feedback loops. We try to point this out, you know, think in systems, build resilience, reskill yourself, and work at the community level where, you know, you can have a lot of influence actually locally and in your own community, even though it's very hard to get through at higher levels of organization and society right now.
Do you think a rapid exodus of millions of people from the cities could help kill off nature? What are the risks of intensification that you write about in your new report?
Oh, that's a great question because, yeah, you'll see this about future scenarios for agriculture often talk about what's called sustainable intensification. And I'm fine with the sustainable part. And, you know, my hairs raise up on the back of my neck when I see intensification because people tend not to be knowledgeable about soils and how to protect them. And typically what happens is intensification, what you're doing is you're trying to get more and more output from the same area of land. And this usually leads to a soil decline and a downward spiral. That's the risk of intensification, is if you don't do it right, it's an easier way, you know, it's a faster way to just drive your soils down. And already our soils around the world are in trouble. So right now, what most soils need is they need they need rest. They need longer rotations. They need less tillage. They need less chemicals applied. So that's actually a de-intensification is what's probably needed for our soils. But the push right now is to intensify more. And it's in good intentions. It's like, well, we need to protect nature. And if we're going to grow. But if you realize what it's coming from is this sense that, oh, well, we're going to go to 10 billion people and they're all going to be eating more meat. So we need to double agricultural output, but we need to do it on a smaller area. So part of this intensification push is this also tied to this projection of vastly more material abundance in the future, which I think is completely wrong.
Well, we've had scientists on the show who have been really concerned about soil loss, but not just the actual loss of the soil, which is pretty important, but the carbon coming out of those soils being released to the atmosphere. But we've also had a couple of small farmers on saying, with the right techniques, we can put more carbon back in, and this could help us with climate change. We can use the soil as a way of helping to avoid that fatally hotter world.
Yeah. Yes, soil can provide some way of drawing down carbon. It's not a panacea. Obviously, soils have released a lot of carbon. In agricultural systems around the world, about half of soil carbon has been released. So some contribution to the excess CO2 in the air is because of a loss of soil carbon. And we can put that back. That doesn't mean, though, that we can really capture not just the carbon that has been lost from soil and bring it back, but then also compensate for all the fossil fuels that have been released. Sometimes this gets overblown, But yes, definitely, we need to put carbon back in the soil. It's one of the key things we need to do to make soils productive in the absence of fossil fuels and the fertilizers derived from them. So it goes hand in hand with feeding ourselves and helping reduce risk of climate instability.
Jason Bradford, talk to us about the key role of natural gas in modern agribusiness, and is there a way to keep up food production but use a lot less of that gas that comes from crazy sources like fracking?
Yeah, sure. So the big use for natural gas in agriculture that people think about is the Haber-Bosch process to manufacture nitrogen fertilizers. And so nitrogen gas in the atmosphere is like 78% of what we're breathing in right now is nitrogen gas, but it's an extremely stable form, and so it's not available chemically. So what natural gas does, it provides both the energy to split the bonds and the hydrogen to reduce the nitrogen gas. So you add hydrogen to the nitrogen, and then you get products like ammonia, and then that's further processed so that it's solid and can be spread as a fertilizer. So if you do the math, you know, about something like half the nitrogen that's in our bodies right now has gone through this industrial process before getting into our food. Now, you can do other things. You can, if you don't have natural gas, you can probably reduce nitrogen using hydrogen captured by electrolysis. But, you know, we don't have a whole industry set up to do this right now, and it's probably hard to scale that. We might eventually say, imagine a future where we have periodic excess wind or periodic excess solar power. Maybe a good way to store that energy is by making fixing nitrogen. But the biggest way to reduce our dependence on synthetic fertilizers is to incorporate legumes as cover crops, sow legumes in pastures that rotate into other crops, because these plants, these would be like beans and peas and clovers, they naturally, with the help of a bacteria, they naturally do this process of fixing nitrogen and bring it into the soil, enriching the soil. That's the main one. But, you know, you got to think of industrial agriculture is industrial, quote unquote. So natural gas is used in all kinds of ways, right? It's used in drying crops. The food processing industry uses it for heating, cooking fuel in homes, key fuel in the electric grid, which keeps our food cold. So once you look beyond the farm, there's actually much more energy use in the food system off the farm, mostly to give us processed convenience foods, you know, to let us eat out of season and to get food from anywhere in the world. And that's where a lot of the savings comes. And that's why I see food as being more localized and less processed.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Jason Bradford, a farmer, a biologist, and a leader at the Post Carbon Institute. And your report, Jason, it contains a section on stress events to watch for. In my opinion, we've already had one key food stress event, and that was when Russia cut off wheat exports during the drought, heat, and fires there in 2010. What should we watch for in the future?
Yeah, you know, I am worried about bringing up natural gas again. I'm worried about natural gas prices availability going up, diesel as well. They're tied to this fracking industry that's going on. And then what this does to the cost of food. Almost any mature industry like agriculture and the food system and, say, grocery retail or restaurants, these businesses, they all start operating as they evolve into a pretty narrow profit margin. They get good at just knowing they can clear a little bit every year. And as energy costs go up, though, this can quickly make the food system unprofitable at about every step, from buying fertilizer to irrigating crops to renting equipment to processing food to shipping it here and there to keeping the retail stores open with all their energy and the refrigeration and lights. And in such an environment, there would be a lot of general economic stress as well, right? So these energy costs trickle into every aspect of the economy. So this would mean that people would be less able to afford food. So, you know, this brings up the scenario, which what happens when your cost of doing business goes up, but your customers have less money to spend. And so that often what you get is you get this inflationary pulse with commodity prices spiking, and then you get a deflationary, you know, pulse because people just can't afford the products. and businesses start shutting down or laying people off. So that's one of the ones I worry about happening relatively soon.
Well, last October, we had the first extended English language interview with the French author Jean-Marc Jancovici. And I just want to read you a quick quote. He said, "I don't believe a single second that we're going to keep the standard of living that we have today on Earth with 7 billion people and just renewables. You can just forget that. It will never happen, never. We can only live with renewables with 500 million people and the standard of living 2 centuries ago. And we know, because we have already had this experience once, that, we know, is possible." That seems a bit harsh. What's your reading on that?
Well, you know, what's interesting is this is something I don't hear very often, but I think he's really right about the limits to renewables. You know, I don't want anyone to get me wrong and just hear this and say, oh, you know, he's poo-pooing the need to get off fossil fuels and invest in renewables. No, we need to do that. We really need to do that because a little bit of electricity can go a long way to easing life. But what won't happen is we won't have enough solar panels or wind turbines to run our consumer economy and replace fossil fuels as they deplete. It would just take a massive manufacturing effort to make enough of this equipment. It takes energy to do this. You know, we don't make solar panels with solar panels. We make them with fossil fuels. And the amount of energy in coal, oil, and natural gas that we use every day is so massive that, you know, we no longer have enough fossil fuel reserves to do that build out and keep everything else going. Now, regarding how many people can live on Earth as the oil age comes to an end, I don't really know. 500 million may be right. Or, you know, part of me goes to the notion that, you know, we've learned a lot since the early 1800s, prior to the Industrial Revolution. We can maybe responsibly carry more people than existed in 1820. But then a lot depends on how well we manage the remaining natural resources and whether we destroy the ecosystems we will need to support us. So the other side says, well, the environment was in much better shape 200 years ago, and people knew how to get by without fossil fuels, and that makes me then more pessimistic. So it's tough to say, really.
It is. It's very difficult, and I know that in my own village here, it seems only the seniors know how to really grow veggies and how to store food over the winter, which is pretty important in the northern climates. Are we really going to convert the iPhone generation and the Instagram folks to digging in the dirt?
Oh, that's a really good question about the iPhone generation. I hope so. You know, but I also want to point out that there's so much more to be done than farming itself. People are going to need to work on a total redesign and rebuild of food and energy systems to be renewable and regenerative. And so I guess if you're not attracted to digging in the dirt, so to speak, I am, I love it, but not everyone is, realize it's going to take a diverse skill set to do that. And I have one of my sons is not much of a green thumb, but gosh, he's mechanically inclined and loves doing stuff. So he fixes tools, he helps build things. That's really necessary too.
And I find another thing that really bothers me is if so few of us know how to collect seeds and we're planting hybrids that don't leave us with viable seeds, I think we need to increase that knowledge and pass it on to the next generations. And maybe we need a return to the heritage varieties.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I agree with you that it's tough because these hybrids work, but you know the reason they work is because they've been worked on so well. It definitely breeding programs that encourage open pollinated varieties, they can produce just as well as the hybrids if you do them right. So we just haven't worked on it. And crop breeding that thinks about through these issues of not just open pollination, but thinks through issues of crops that are adapted to organic soil conditions is really important because a lot of the root systems that we have now and the crops that we have are sort of accustomed to these synthetic fertilizers. And so a big need is to make sure that we have crops that are going to do the work to access organic nutrients and work with the soil biology. And that often has genetic components that get lost with long-term breeding in conventional agricultural systems.
And then, Jason, we have the claim that heavily urbanized humans actually save emissions per capita compared to rural people. A person, say, living in New York may not have a car. They may use more efficient mass transit, have a smaller carbon footprint than someone living in Montana or Missouri or Oregon. Do you think that's really true?
You know, in some ways it is, but it's also a really, you know, oversimplified view of the situation. And this is where thinking in systems is important. So look at the history of what's happened. By depopulating the countryside in the U.S., you know, we've made life a lot more difficult for those people who remain. And I know people who farm and ranch for a living, you know, who put on 40,000 miles a year in their vehicle. And you say, my gosh, you know, how can they do that? Well, they have to. They have to because their jobs have them covering thousands of acres to manage crops and livestock. So we've made it a policy to have fewer and fewer people grow our food. And that means that those that remain are driving around like crazy. They also tend to live in or near small towns that, because the population has dropped so low, have lost basic services such as grocery stores, schools, post office, and so on. And now they've got to drive an hour to the nearest sizable city. But, you know, this is weird. The U.S. is really weird. You also then have people that live, say, 20 miles outside of a city and then just have the luxury of commuting into a job. So this is sort of a rural lifestyle, not really rural workers. And so if you look around the world in general and you ask yourself, are the rural folks the ones who've joined the consumer society that, you know, are buying all this goods and services? No, right? You're not getting Amazon drop shipments to your village in Ecuador, right? So what happens is, though, when migrants go to the city and they have now opportunity for, you know, shopping, that's when you start to see consumption go up in general. And the U.S. is just a really weird case because of our history.
And how does the vision of a return to the rural relate to the World Made by Hand series, that sort of semi-fictional work by James Howard Kunstler?
Right. I think I read the first book. It came out quite a while ago. And if I recall correctly, it's set after a fast crash of civilization. It's not exactly clear what happened, but, you know, there's people that talk about how quickly things went haywire. And that, you know, maybe that's the way one way things could go. Now, my hope would be that there's a saner transition. And so, you know, the reason this report is out is to improve the odds of that happening versus something happening really fast.
And I think the mantra of many environmentalists and energy watchers is we have to develop local resources to feed ourselves. But there is a slight risk with that, in my opinion, because we want to be flexible if extreme weather events, maybe driven by climate change, make local production impossible for a few years, say by a big drought like California had. Won't we need those large global food flows to cope with climate change?
Yes, definitely. This report, you know, really pushes localism, right? But it's not dogmatic about it for exactly what you just said. We really want to have regional connections and regional trade for maybe very specialty high-value items, say medicines, and also in case there's a problem, like you're saying, a localized famine, and you can trade surplus in one area for another. So it's not about total isolationism. It's about, you know, in the context of energy becoming really scarce, what do you need to do locally as much as possible, and what do you have to keep open in terms of trade for various reasons, either, like I said, specialized, high-value things you need to grow, or manufacture, and then having greater food security still. So yes, I think that's an important point.
And I think other people too point to the experience of Cuba when it was suddenly cut off from sugar exports and from oil imports when the Soviet Union collapsed around 1991. There's been films made about it, a lot of talk about it. Do you think that's still a viable example of how we can handle this coming situation?
Yes, I think it can teach us a lot. Not only did Cuba have to quickly adopt organic agriculture and start breeding oxen, but they set up a system of rationing limited food and fuel and also sharing of transportation. So if you were driving and someone wanted to ride, you had space in your vehicle, you had to stop. So imagine how nice to know if I'm hitchhiking, someone's going to stop for me. And also urban farming became really promoted. And there was a general sense of we are in this together that kept the society from breaking down.
And one of the things I like about your report is you lay out the logic of why this is bound to happen, but you don't set a date. You don't say, well, this is going to happen by 2035 for sure, because there's just It's such a complex system, but we do know that there is an inevitable logic about fossil fuels will eventually run out and climate change really is happening. So this is going to be the eventual answer. Did I get that right?
Yeah. I mean, people often wow, this is a big trend that has been going on, this urbanization, and how could you predict the opposite? Well, once you understand the energetic basis of society and what's allowed for urbanization and globalization to really go for it like it has, and you see that renewables are not going to step up and replace that, this does become kind of an obvious logical step. And so that's why I lay it out clearly, because it is a bit like, you know, wow, no one expected this coming. But yeah, it's not hard to understand. It's just, you know, saying when it happens is hard. It also, it could happen in different places, you know, at different times. And I think a lot of it's going to be driven by financial situations. So I give an example of Greece in the report. So member of the EU, right? But the credit for Greece, the government of Greece doesn't get extended. It goes to an austerity program. People start losing jobs. And the next thing you know, people in their 20s are jobless in Athens, and so they go back to their rural homes. And that's the kind of thing, you'll see it through a financial lens, but the financial system and the energy system are intimately tied. People don't recognize that. But as we have less and less energy, it'll be harder and harder to get things to happen with money.
So the new report, The Future is Rural, Food System Adaptations to the Great Simplification. Where can people get it, and why should we invest the time to read it?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, it's from the Post Carbon Institute, so that's postcarbon.org, and just look for publications on that website. David Hughes is going to get a new report out soon, and there's a podcast, actually, we've been producing called Crazy Town. I don't know if you've seen that. We just got a couple episodes out now. You know, I wouldn't have written this if I didn't think it was both necessary and somewhat of a unique contribution to what's already out there. Right? There's so many books that are getting published. But really, this is the only place I know where a realistic appraisal of energy futures is integrated with I would say, you know, given my background now, an expert view of the food system. So I have an odd and diverse background as an academic scientist. I did a lot of nonprofit activism. Was a very small kind of farmer with hand tools, an avid backyard gardener. I end up managing a large agribusiness, you know, managing thousands of acres of crops and livestock. I work with local governments. So I'm in a position to see the world from so many perspectives and then take the time to think about how to present this challenging subject so non-experts can put this kind of information to use.
You've been listening to Jason Bradford from the Post Carbon Institute, and you can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org or go to postcarbon.org. Jason, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Hey, thanks, Alex, and thanks for the great questions.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Climate Countdown 2019. Rough sea. Full moon. The tide is coming in.
Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock this week, and my thanks to the scientists and authors who come on this program and share all their good things. They don't get paid anything, and in fact, we're doing this to get the word out to you, and I hope you will spread it out to other people. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Yanis Varoufakis, The Crash of 2008 and the Pandemic of 2020, The Combination that Changed Capitalism Forever. On July 2, 2020, the economist and former finance minister of Greece, Yanis Varoufakis, gave a webinar on how the current collapse of the world economy might change capitalism forever. And it might do so by challenging the survival of private banking and the functioning of the stock exchange. Varoufakis' thesis reminded me of the headline in the September 2019 New Yorker from Bill McKibben's divestment campaign. It said, "Money is the oxygen on which the fire of global warming burns." What would it be like to abandon not just a particular investment by a bank, but the whole banking system? In this half-hour program, you will meet Rob Johnson, who moderated the talk organized by INET, the Institute for New Economic Thinking based in New York City. Rob Johnson.
Good morning, everyone, or afternoon in the case of our speaker. I'm Rob Johnson, the president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. INET's very excited and pleased to present Yanis Varoufakis on the crash of 2008, the pandemic of 2020, and the combination that changed capitalism forever. Yanis is an economist, philosopher, author, politician. He's a member of the Hellenic Parliament, Secretary General of MayRa 25, and the co-founder of DiEM 25. He was the former finance minister of Greece. Together with Bernie Sanders, he co-founded Progressive International to unite progressives around the world. He's taught economics at University of Cambridge, University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of several books, including Adults in the Room and The Weak Suffer What They Must and The Global Minotaur. My personal experience included a wonderful podcast with he and his wife just a few weeks ago that you can find in the Economics and Beyond series. And I will confess you can feel my heartfelt affection for this brave and imaginative man. I remember back at our Paris conference when he and Joe Stiglitz and I had a conversation, how moved I was with the courage and the illumination that he brings to bear throughout his professional and personal life. Yanis, thank you for being with us here today.
Rob, it's always a great pleasure to be with you in proximity or through teleconferencing. Thank you so much for the introduction. And thank you for asking me to talk about something that really touches me. Because today, there is this tendency by almost everyone, isn't there? Almost every commentator compares and contrasts the current disaster, 2020, the COVID-19-induced pause in economic activity across the world, more or less, to the crash of 2008. And the reason why I'm a bit miffed by this comparison is my conviction that it is a mistake. 2020 is not a different crisis. It's an escalation of the crisis that started in 2008. But let's begin at the beginning, as they say. In the era of global capital flows and financialization, which proceeded apace after the end of Bretton Woods, to be indulging in the standard economic analysis, looking at the American economy, the British economy, the Greek economy, the Japanese economy, all those nation-state-based analyses are bound to mislead. If we have learned anything from the last 12 years or so, maybe longer, it is that it is pointless to continue to do macroeconomic analysis the way we used to, focusing on a single country and looking at its weaknesses and strengths. The key to unlocking the mysteries around us is not anymore trade volumes or fiscal data. It is the ebb and flow of financial capital. This is why financialization has changed capitalism and the world we live in so profoundly, and why the crash of 2008, which wounded financialization very significantly, has changed the world in such a way that now a mindless piece of RNA, not even DNA, you know, COVID-19, comes along with such profound impact, because financialized capitalism was in such dire straits before COVID-19 hit us. So it is through this prism that I want us to have this conversation today of understanding 2020 as an escalation of something large that started occurring in 2008 and which never left us. The crisis I shall be proposing of financialization in 2008 never went away. Financial markets recovered, lots of money was made in them. But financialization as the linchpin of globalized capitalism has never managed to heal its wounds from 2008. In other words, if I'm correct in my hypothesis, to understand the post-COVID-19 world that we're all so keen to talk about, we cannot do that independently of understanding the post-2008 world. Now, let's take it right from the start. Once upon a time, money moved between countries, mostly to finance trade.
My apologies for interrupting this promising beginning of the story of how once upon a time money moved between countries, mostly to finance trade. I recommend you pick up Yanis Varoufakis' talk from July 2nd, 2020 on YouTube. Here now, I'm moving into the question and answer section, where Varoufakis presents his most challenging ideas in practical application. Rob Johnson will be responding to Yanis Varoufakis' concluding words of his 30-minute speech.
To wind it down so that we can shift to the Q&A part that I'm very much looking forward to, my thought for the moment is that capitalism is not what it used to be. Financialization, and particularly its demise in 2008, has created new contradictions that even Karl Marx could not have imagined. At the same time, progressives are nowhere near organizing a political movement internationally in order to use state power to rejig and to plan again an economy that works for the many, not a socialism for the very, very, very few, which is what we have today. This lacuna of political organization, the lack of Franklin Roosevelt today, the lack of a political movement that can actually put the financial genie back into its bottle and rethink property rights over the new technologies that are upending capitalism anyway, separately from its crisis with financialization. This lacuna is putting us on effectively a fork in the road where we as a species must decide which way we're going to go. Are we going to move towards a dystopia in which a stagnant capitalism, 2008-2020, yields an industrial feudalism with a very few barricaded behind very tall walls and electrified fences in gated communities, and out there, you know, you have scenes like Escape from New York, if you remember the John Carpenter movie, or we're going to move into a post-capitalism that combines rationality with solidarity. Thank you.
Very, very powerful, Yanis. Very historical. What reforms do you think we have to look in the eye and demand as people to unlock the constrictions on the representation of the demos?
Ah, well, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? A year ago, I would have answered in a New Dealer kind of way. So what we need is to revive the important idea behind Roosevelt's New Deal of mobilizing public finance for public purpose. I still believe in that. Except that now the crisis has escalated with COVID-19 to such an extent that I think it's not enough. It's important. It's a necessary condition, but it is not a sufficient condition. Because even if we manage to do it, you know, think of Bretton Woods. Bretton Woods was a, despite its many, many, many malignancies, it was a remarkable experiment in constraining finance and shrinking inequality. Nevertheless, the system that is predicated upon capital accumulation on the basis of the separation of who works in a company and who owns the company, and the ownership of the company through the stock exchange is turbocharged through financialization. You know, even if we took Franklin Roosevelt, John Maynard Keynes, you know, Jesus Christ, the Buddha, we put them all together, and they and their angels or, you know, minions designed the global system, this process, which combines private finance and stock exchanges, will find a way of subverting it and creating another 15th of August 1971, which was the end of Bretton Woods, if you remember, when Richard Nixon was forced effectively by the system's fragmentation to end Bretton Woods. So I think that this is not just a question of mobilizing existing liquidity for good purpose. We need to do that, absolutely. It is necessary, but as I said, it's not sufficient. So what would make it sufficient? A redistribution not just of income, but of property rights. For me, the more I think about it, you know, I go back to an interesting moment in 1599, when in London, at the time when William Shakespeare was finishing off or up Hamlet, we had this remarkable decision to found the East India Company, the first joint stock corporation, with shares that were anonymous and liquid, and they could be bought and sold like pieces of silver. You know, that is a pretty remarkable thing to do, right? It's pretty remarkable thing to decide that we're going to have a huge corporation, and ownership is going to be anonymous, liquid, and tradable. And independently of what this company does, who works in it, what effect it has on the world, on the environment, on the people that it exploits or it deals with. I'm increasingly drawn to the idea of shares like library cards. How about that? Does it sound very name? You go to school, you go to college, you know, you go to the New York University or Stanford or whatever, you know, your community college, and you're given a library card. It's yours. You use it. You can't sell it. You cannot even rent it or lease it to someone. It gives you access to knowledge. So how about, you know, corporations where you have one person, one vote, one share, and, you know, you accumulate capital in it on the basis of bonuses. I'm not talking about everybody receiving the same amount of money. You can have bonuses that are very different depending on how esteemed your contribution is amongst your colleagues, and there are voting systems that can generate that. And then when you leave, you take, you know, you trade one library card for another. You go from one college to another. You go from one company to another. That would be, of course, the end of the stock exchange. I think, and, you know, I've just finished a book about this, Rob. This is why, you know, I dare speak those words, because I've put a lot of thought into it. And then my book is coming out in September. Trying to imagine post-capitalism. The more I think of it, the more I come to the conclusion that for markets to work well, we need to end capitalism, which means what? To end private banking and end stock exchanges. So every corporation is a cooperative, one member, one share, one vote, and there's no private banking. We don't need private banking. You know, the Fed could grant every U.S. resident a bank account. You know, what is the point of having intermediaries? You know, think about the absurdity of quantitative easing. Yeah, there is a pandemic, the economy goes down the toilet, like now, right? And what the Fed does is it lends money to Bank of America, or, you know, to Citibank, in the hope that Bank of America and Citibank is going to give it, pass it on to the people and to companies to do good things with that. Now, whenever you put a private banker between the central bank and markets out there, or society, most of it disappears or ends up being misused. Because, you know, bankers have a, as you know, they have a very clear rule, never lend it to people who actually need it or who will do good things with it. Lend it to people who will speculate with it. If rational extraterrestrials were to visit planet Earth and look at stock exchanges, look at all this activity, these brilliant minds that were all day shuffling paper around, or it's not even paper anymore, it's, you know, ions in some digital space, with financial engineering and all that, creating just, you know, as Paul Volcker said, you know, when he was, remember when his comment when he was told about all the wonderful financial engineering that was invented, he said, you know, in all my years in this business, all I have seen is new forms of debt being invented, right? So if we had, you know, imagine if each one of us had a digital account at the Fed, maybe two accounts, three accounts, a savings account and a checking account, whatever. And whenever there was a crisis like now, the Fed could simply type into our accounts an additional amount of money to spend, so as not to allow, you know, demand to crash, like, you know, in the middle of a pandemic now. That would work so well, and there would be no point in paying all those huge fees to bankers. And if you end the combination of private banking and share markets, then suddenly, you know, we have corporations where, you know, we make decisions democratically within them on the basis of one share, one vote. Okay? And it's remarkable how sensible people can be when given an opportunity to vote about things in their own outfits, whether it's a corporation or, you know, a town hall meeting. So how about, yeah, the idea of democratizing the economy, which means, doesn't mean the end of markets. It means the end of share markets and private banking. Therefore, I will finish off with this hypothesis of mine, because I like hearing it. I'm going to repeat it once more. The only way to have properly functioning markets is to end capitalism.
That's a beautiful paradox. One of our audience is watching from Senegal and asked the question, I can see clearly the paradoxes and their impact in the developed countries. Can you say a bit about how this plays out for the developing countries like Senegal?
Oh, thank you so much for asking this question to our friend, because it's so important. The relationship between developed economies and economies like Senegal has always been hugely important and toxic. Remember that very soon after the collapse of Bretton Woods in 1971, it was the developing countries that suffered the trials and tribulations of the first debt crisis created by the emerging financialization. Remember the structural adjustment programs of the International Monetary Fund? They started in places like Senegal, in Kenya, and so on, before, once they had honed them completely, before they brought them into the midst of Europe with the Troika programs in Greece, in Ireland, and so on and so forth. So we are all interconnected in this. The connection of the present conundrum that I described in my introduction, in my speech, if you want, with what's happening in Senegal today. I think the linchpin is the ill effects of massive minting of dollars by the Fed to keep corporates alive, because of the spillovers of this money that, you remember, immediately after 2009, 2010, there was a gash of dollars going to developing countries, seeking higher rates of return than they could find in the United States or in Europe. That created bubbles in Senegal and other countries, with the local oligarchs making ill use of this increasing debt that was coming into the country from the quantitative easing packages of the Bank of Japan, of the Bank of the Fed, of the Bank of England, and so on. That creates artificial wealth in countries like Senegal. It empowers the local oligarchs against the majority of the Senegalese. And then once panic sets in, the financial markets in Wall Street, in the City of London, and so on, the money that flooded into Senegal, flood out of Senegal, the bubbles burst in Senegal, in the developing countries, and then the IMF comes in and demands the expropriation of your waterworks, your electricity grids, and the closure of your schools and your hospitals. So we're in this together. This is why I made the point that it is a gross error to imagine that we live in a world of the Americans against the Chinese, of the, you know, the Europeans against the Senegalese. No, this is a class war that is raging in every country, and the oligarchy without frontiers are very united in this. So to my friend in Senegal, your oligarchy are on very good terms with our oligarchy here in Greece, with the German oligarchy, with the American oligarchy. They have bonds of solidarity that I only wish the rest of the of humanity had.
I've got a couple of questions that feel to me like they were designed to help the president of INET with his agenda. So I'm very happy to ask. He said, could Yanis share his thoughts on the subject of economics? Are there any theories or areas in the current state that can accommodate his vision and analysis? And if not, what would be appropriate in the medium term? And then the other that comes forward is, you mentioned a lack of strong progressive political movement. Is there a room for conversation on post-capitalism? And if so, what can economists and their political aides do to make it palatable to the average citizen to embrace? In other words, breaking through the ideologies that have been our false consciousness up to this time.
I'll start with the politics and then go to the economics, Rob, if I may. The answer is that, you know, this is a good moment to make inroads into the global political scene and to come up with what some of us are putting together in the form of a progressive international, a global political movement that thinks globally and acts like activists locally. I'll give you a small example, right? Remember sometime when it was in March, the story of Chris Smalls, the Amazon employee that was vilified as a result of having dared to strike or to organize a strike in New Jersey in one of the warehouses of Amazon, you know, protesting against unhygienic conditions in the warehouse. He was fired, and from what we now know, there was quite a long discussion in the board of directors of the richest corporation in the world on how to vilify him or to portray him in the media as inarticulate. Imagine if we had a global movement, let's call it the Progressive International, because some of us are creating one. We first inaugurated in November 2018 in Vermont between the Sanders Institute and our Democracy in Europe movement. In September, we are moving to Reykjavik in Iceland under the aegis of Katrin Jakobsdottir, who is the Prime Minister of Iceland, to give it another boost, to give the Progressive International another boost. So imagine if this Progressive International existed and was functioning back in March, and we could organize a worldwide strike against Amazon, consumer strike, to say, people, you know, just one day, do not even visit their site. Just one day, it's not a big deal. It's not a great cost to people not to visit the Amazon site just one day. But that, if it was successful at an international level, Chris Smalls would not have been fired. And we were to combine, you know, solidarity with one worker, one warehouse in New Jersey, with global action. And imagine we could do this every day, one day in Nigeria, another day in India, another day in China, another day in Hong Kong, in Greece, and so on. This, to me, is what is necessary.
We're coming to the end of our time, but I want to ask you one last question, and it relates to green energy. Mm-hmm. Given this austerity prolonged recession, given the deficiency of aggregate demand, is it possible to create what I'll call a green Keynesianism, a green fiscal policy to transform the economy and make it more resilient.
Well, we ran in the last European Parliament election under the Green New Deal. So the answer is absolutely yes. But you see, remember that I mentioned before that since 2008, we had this disconnect, huge savings, very little investment. All we need to do, we need to take the savings and invest it. That's all we need to do, which was, of course, the original idea of FDR, Franklin Roosevelt. That was the original idea of the New Deal. You use public finance instruments in order to shift idle liquidity, idle cash, into investments. So that's what we need to do. We can do it. It's not difficult at all. Imagine a situation where, you know, in the same way that the central banks got together to save finance, imagine that we had the treasuries getting together with the World Bank to create public financial instruments, you know, green bonds that are issued collectively. Yeah? And the central banks agree to make one statement that we will buy them in the secondary markets if needs be to keep the interest rates low. Suddenly you have a huge amount of money that you can spend on green energy. So the technicalities are straightforward of how to use existing, we're not talking about creating money, we're talking about using existing money, existing savings, and putting it into good use. So yes, we can do it, but who's going to do it? You know, Roosevelt is dead, and and we didn't do very well in the European Parliament elections last year when we had this this program. One of the reasons why we didn't do well was because we did not have the money to compete with campaign financing with the juggernauts who were supported by the banking sector.
Well, Yanis, we've covered a lot of ground, a lot of, how would I say, deep and painful things to explore.
Thank you
for what you do for the world and to become more active and create a healthy vision for the future. And you are a contributor to that path.
Thank you so much, Rob.
Thank you.
That was a goodbye between Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and Yanis Varoufakis, philosopher and teacher of economics at the University of Cambridge and the University of Austin, Texas. He's the former finance minister of Greece and now member of the Hellenic Parliament. Together with Bernie Sanders, he co-founded the Progressive International. You can find the full talk and Q&A on YouTube under the title The Crash of 2008 and the Pandemic of 2020, the combination that changed capitalism forever. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.